need some help down here. Can anybody hear me? We found something. We found something. We found something.
12 men have just discovered something. For 100,000 years, it was buried in the snow and ice. Now it has found a place to live. Inside. Where no one can see it. Or hear it. Or feel it.
I know I'm human. Some of you are still human. This thing doesn't want to show itself. It wants to hide inside an imitation. It'll fight if it has to. But it's vulnerable out in the open. If it takes us over, then it has no more enemies. Nobody left to kill it. And then it's one.
You guys gonna listen to Gary? We can beat one of those things!
Today we're gonna talk about John Carpenter's classic 1982 film, The Thing. Some say this is the greatest horror movie ever produced, ever created. I disagree with that, but hey, you know what? I'm here to talk to you about it because the themes and the ideas all fit into the scope of the John Carpenter Apocalypse trilogy, which hopefully you listened to my intro show where I sort of broke down the ideas behind the Apocalypse trilogy and what this is all about. It's about nothing. It's about no thing. It's about nihilism. Destroying everything. Annihilation and nihilism. John Carpenter seems to want to show us this end of everything over three films. Three great films. I don't want to make it sound like I'm not a fan of The Thing. And of course there's going to be plot spoilers, but we're going to go through the whole movie here. I'll walk you along in case you've never seen it. But yes, there will be plot spoilers. Should you see it? Yes. Is it worth it? Yes. I'll warn you this much though. It's very grotesque. You cannot eat food whilst watching this movie. It is gooey gory. I'm going to give you a little background info on the movie. I'm going to give you a little bit on the who's in the movie, and then we're going to go through the film. And a great film. You can see there's plenty of homages and like little videos people have done about this, interviews, podcasts. I mean, it's quite a cult classic because when it came out, it didn't do so hot. It took a while for people to catch on. It's an odd parallel to Alien, Ridley Scott's Alien. So there's that. Dan O'Bannon wrote the screenplay for Alien, which was adapted from a story titled The Star Beast. Well, O'Bannon, he attended the University of South Carolina. I'm sorry, Southern California. They don't have film schools in South Carolina, do they? I don't know. Southern California. But anyways, he was, O'Bannon was there at school with John Carpenter. And they did a film together called The Dark Star, which was technically John Carpenter's first film. And if you watch Dark Star, it's got a lot of alien-esque themes in it. So The Thing is, in some ways, a weird parallel to Alien because the guy behind Alien was also sort of a, influence on Carpenter. And of course, the tale, it comes from a novella that was called Who Goes There? One of these science fiction pulp magazines. Pulp magazines, of course, started by the founder of the OTO. Talk about that in Use Your Illusion 1. And that's why we're talking about this movie, because I'm going to have this analysis in Use Your Illusion 2. See, you don't even have to buy the book. See how much I care about you. This is going to be one of the analyses in the book. I'm going to go through the whole Carpenter Apocalypse trilogy in the book because it's relevant. Yes. Not as much relevant in the first, in The Thing, but more. It gets more relevant as the films go along. And of course, In the Mouth of Madness is the most relevant of the three. But anyways, in this novella called Who Goes There, it's about these scientists in Antarctica who are... They discover a UFO, and this UFO has been buried in the ice for 20 million years. Alien wakes up. And this alien, it can take on the appearance of any living thing that it consumes. It can replicate their personalities and their memories, but it can also read their minds and project thoughts telepathically, which is, it's not so much in the film, The Thing, 1982 Carpenter film, but that plot line to me is part of the big scheme here in the idea of the mental component in the alien agenda. Because that's what they do. They lock in telepathically with the host. That's you. When you're out there in the desert with Stephen Greer meditating, channeling the UFOs with Demi Lovato. You thought you were just having a good time. Next thing you know, bam. You're locked in telepathically. And then you're getting ready for the, the probe. The probe. Now, the first film adaptation of this was actually back in 1951 called The Thing from Another World. This version had the alien, the Thing, up at the North Pole, taking on the shape of Santa Claus, I would believe. And then, ironically, wasn't the last blockbuster up there at the North Pole in Alaska? Correct me if I'm wrong. See how... You know, you were back at Blockbuster in the 90s renting movies. You were probably renting The Thing. And little did you know that the original predecessor took place up there at the North Pole in Alaska, where the last Blockbuster would ever exist. Then in 1982, The Thing, John Carpenter's, actually had a prequel afterwards from 2011, which confusingly also called The Thing. And if you want to keep up to date on this stuff, in 2019, they published a book called Frozen Hell because they actually discovered the full-length version of that novella, the Who Goes There novella. They actually discovered a full-length version of it, and they published it. So you can, like I said, you can go as deep into this mythology of The Thing as you want. But I'm talking about John Carpenter's version today, 1982, Kurt Russell, beautiful feathered hair. And, you know, John Carpenter's a legend. Before this, he had done Halloween. The first installment of Halloween with Michael Myers, you know. And you can see, in fact, when you watch Halloween, the first one with Jamie Lee Curtis and Michael Myers and all that, you can see the Thing from Another World, the 1951 version where the alien takes over Santa Claus and Blockbuster. You can see that on a television set in the film Halloween. How fun is that? He knew he wanted to do this movie even back in, I believe it was 78 that he filmed Halloween. Now, originally, Universal Studios was going to have Tobe Hooper direct this. Tobe Hooper. You know Tobe Hooper from Texas Chainsaw Massacre? He did a bunch of classics. I think he did Last House on the Left, if I'm not mistaken. I could be wrong about that. Don't quote me on that. But they didn't like his draft on it. So Carpenter, he actually teamed up with Burt Lancaster to be the screenwriter. And prior to The Thing, Burt Lancaster had only been... he had only written one other film, The Bad News Bears. How fun is that? Now, in this movie, everyone's going to have their own interpretation of this. So you're going to hear my interpretation, and then you're going to study it a little bit more and be like, well, wait a minute, that's not what this person's saying. Well, maybe not, because there's different interpretations. And that's kind of one of the things about this movie that keeps it a cult classic. And the reason it's a cult classic is because it's the archetypal underdog. It released the same exact time as Blade Runner. And right after E.T., which I'm also going to do a film analysis for. Stay liked and stay subscribed. Because that one's also going in the book, but it's going in your ear. But yeah, E.T. and Blade Runner, they totally screwed this film up. Didn't have a chance. The masses, the mouth-breathing masses, they didn't like it because they wanted Reese's Pieces and Harrison Ford. But now, fast forward 40 years, and people claim this is the best horror movie of all time, which I don't really agree with. I don't love it that much. But, you know, this puts Carpenter up as about as high on the horror pedestal as one could be. I mean, this guy gave us Halloween, which is like the most profitable film of all time. Which Halloween, that, I would argue that might be one of, that might be the greatest film. I don't know what my favorite horror film is. What's the greatest horror movie of all time? I don't know yet. Gotta do some thinking about that. It's hard to pick just one, you know? Now, the cast. Let's talk about who's in this. Kurt Russell, he plays R.J. MacReady. Great little name there, R.J. And you know who Kurt Russell is. He's Kurt Russell in the movie. He's a little salty, he's a little surly. Then you got Keith David, another great. He plays the character Childs. And then old Wilford Brimley plays Dr. Blair. And you wouldn't even know it's him. This is Wilford Brimley minus the big giant walrus mustache. Pre-diabetes Wilford Brimley. So yeah, that's it. That's the setup. And it's 109 minutes, by the way. And it feels like it. It feels like they could have cut 20 to 40 out. I know that's probably sacrilegious, but to me, it just felt like it drug on a little bit too long, about 20 minutes too long. That's all. Not that bad, though. It's still a great movie, still a classic. On my scale of how much should you want to see this, I bought it on, I believe, Amazon. I bought it on Amazon for like, I don't know, I think it was like less than 10 bucks. Definitely worth that. It's got a couple repeat values. I mean, it's not considered one of the greatest movies of all time for no reason. It's just for me, it's mostly like action and gore. Like it's known for having the animatronics and the sort of real life horror goo, and that was pretty much like the pinnacle of that. And it was kind of out of left field, like people weren't ready for this level of Fangoria. And now we went to CGI, so this would be it. This is the first and last, right? Now the film. Let's talk about the film. It starts out, and I'm going to put the photos on the Instagram, at Isaac Weishaupt. Like and subscribe. Hit the link in the show notes, and you'll see all the images we're talking about, which I'm also going to put these images in the book, just for fun, because I like pictures. That which also drives the price of the book up, by the way, significantly. I printed Kubrick's code with color images, and the cost of printing in color pictures is outrageous. Like Kubrick's code, if you buy the paperback in color, it's like $35 because it costs like $30 to print the damn thing. So I don't know. I might print it in black and white to keep the cost down a little bit. I don't know. We'll see. I'll see if they can make two versions. Okay, let's start out. The photo. There's a UFO. It's crashing into the Earth. And it crashes in Antarctica. It's 1982. And the UFO is, of course, your classic saucer. And we see there in Antarctica, there's a U.S. science outpost. It actually, the sign says it's the National Science Institute Post 4. But then later, R.J. MacReady calls it the U.S. Outpost 31. Don't ask me. Same thing. I don't know. But Kurt Russell, we're introduced to R.J. Kurt Russell. He's drinking. He's playing chess on the computer, and he loses to the computer, and he does what any rational person does. He pours the rest of his whiskey drink onto the motherboard. He's a wild man. He just wrecks what was probably a $5,000 computer back then. He just pours his whiskey down on the motherboard like, screw it. But that's the kind of guy RJ is. He don't take no shorts, no losses, baby. Next. Fun story, by the way. Let me tell you a fun story. One time, you're not going to want to hear it, but here you go. One time, I had like this little crappy 13-inch TV in my bedroom, and I had Sega Genesis. I forget what it was, a baseball game. I think it was called like RBI Baseball or something. And I played my dad on it, And he had a little bit of a temper, okay? He was a real alpha male kind of guy. He didn't take no crap. He was kind of Kurt Russell, right? And I beat him. You know, I was a kid. I'm a loser. I got nothing but time. I'll play games all day long. And he got so pissed, he slammed the controller down and it broke the TV. So, yeah, my dad was kind of Kurt Russell in his own right. Cool story, bro. Okay, next. The Norwegians, they are also in Antarctica. And we see them chasing a dog from a helicopter. Like, they really are after this dog. And this is where worlds collide, and they're now on the territory of the U.S. outpost. And he's trying to shoot this dog from the helicopter. Only he's leading him way too much. And then he lands at the camp, and they're like crazy. These Norwegians are crazy. They got the guns. They're shooting. They're trying to get the dog. But one of the guys at the U.S. camp, he pulls out the blicky and shoots the man dead right in his eye, right in his all-seeing eye, setting up symbolically that we're in for an awakening of the reality of what we could be in for. Again, I'll have that photo up. But the... And what's up with this outpost? You got science nerds and they're like a bunch of badasses. You know, one shot, one kill, right in the eye. Kurt Russell, he's blowing up computers. He don't care. These are some badass scientists. This is like an 80s. These are 80s scientists. So then you hear Kurt Russell. He confirms it's the first week of winter, December 21st. And you know what goes down on December 21st, right? You know what goes down. The Illuminate holiday, the Illuminate ritual. You know, the 21st is the solstice. That's the Saturnalia. That is when the sun god dies and will be resurrected. So this happens over that 3-day period. This whole movie. Coincidence? I think not. Now, everyone at the camp, obviously, they're wondering, what the hell is that all about? But the Norwegians are dead, so they can't figure it out. But they got the dog. Throughout all of that, the dog makes it. And they're trying to reach another base, McMurdo, a real base in Antarctica there. And they want to head over to the base camp where the Norwegians came from, because they're like, well, we killed these Norwegians. We got to go back to where they're from and figure out what's up. And this is where you find out why Kurt Russell's there. He's not a scientist. He's not a nerd. He's a helicopter pilot, of course. So RJ McCready, he hops in that helicopter. And they go over to the Norwegian camp. And you know, there's a recurring joke about he keeps thinking they're the Swedes. But anyways, they get there. It's ominous. It's all charred and burned up. And plot spoiler again, but Carpenter, fun fact, he actually uses the burnt up American camp, because then by the end of the movie, the American camp burns up, okay? But to save some money, he, after they burn it up, they filmed this first scene at their Norwegian camp. And if you look closely, you'll see it's the same exact camp.
Hey everybody, it's your host Isaac, and we have another segment of Conspiracy Considerations. Yes, you know it, you love it. And what this is, if you don't know what I'm talking about, it's the, I've got these supporter platforms, right? You know about them, talk about them all the time. Well, there's a top tier, tier 4, only available on Patreon and IlluminatiWatcher.com's VIP section. And tier 4, the top tier, gets you on the show. You get your own segment of Conspiracy Considerations. And today we are joined by Wally Gorbachev, straight from the USSR. My God. No, pseudonym, of course. Can't be too safe around here. And he's going to talk to us about, well, first he's going to talk to us about this blasphemous idea that Tom Cruise and Leo DiCaprio aren't the best actors. Then we'll get into a little bit of Aleister Crowley and then the Bible and the heptatic structure and how Crowley was just a hater. He was hating on the Bible because he couldn't perfect the fingerprint of God. And then we'll briefly talk about some of the symbolism in the Batman films, and we'll finish off with a reference to a guy named J.D. Farad with the ABCs, and I'll post a link in the show notes for that. And without further ado, let's go. All right, we got Wally on the line. What's up, man?
It's so good to be here. Great podcast. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, most definitely, man. You want to pitch some ideas on the old conspiracy considerations corner here.
Absolutely.
You messaged me with a couple.
Oh, yeah. Your podcast is a lot like the quote from The Exorcism of Emily Rose. When people say that God doesn't exist, but how could they do that if I show them the devil? That's kind of how I encapsulate your podcast.
Yeah, that's funny. That's kind of how it feels when I do all this research, is because because I'm like I always say, I'm a Christian, not a good one, because I have a lot of doubts often.
I'm the worst Christian I know.
Oh yeah. Well, good. We're in good company then. But yeah, that's kind of how it worked for me. Was like, you know, you see all this dark stuff, you see enough of it, and you're like, okay, I'm back in.
Going the other direction. Other direction.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but yeah, man. You got a few ideas on
the Tom Cruise stuff, though. Like Tom Cruise and Leo.
Oh, we're gonna start there. No.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, dude. I've been chomping at the bit to get this one out.
Okay. Let's hear it.
I gotta tell you, both overrated. And I'm just going to give you where I'm coming from first. Sam Rockwell is the best actor right now.
Is he
know who he is?
The name sounds familiar. Is he the guy from that, was it show, Ray on Showtime? Is that him?
Oh, I don't really have Showtime, but he was in The Green Mile. He was William Wharton, and he was in Three Billboards to Ebbing, Missouri. Oh, Galaxy Quest. He was the red shirt guy from Galaxy Quest.
I'd have to look him up. Let me look him up. I got to know who you're talking about.
All right. While
you're
looking
up, I'll
tell you.
For you to say such sacrilegious things about my favorite man.
Oh, my goodness. I'll tell you why Tom Cruise is no good. First of all, it's really easy to be cool and popular when you play an air fighter pilot during the crescendo of the Cold War. I mean, you basically have a ticket for the rest of your life in Hollywood. And also, Jack Nicholson carried him through the whole movie in A Few Good Men.
Okay, all right. Yeah, you know what? In A Few Good Men, I'll give you that that wasn't, like, his strongest role. I don't know if he was supposed to be sort of not the leading man or not the strongest alpha guy in there, but I'll give you that much. I'm looking up your boy
no
here.
No one says, I want the Rocco. Truth. They say you can't handle the truth.
You know, in fact, I'm doing a show with Mrs. Weishaupt, that Breaking Social Norms show, and we're going to talk about our 10 favorite 80s movies. And I'm going to I've got a pre-canned statement about Tom Cruise, because as you could imagine, Top Gun is more than likely to show up in my top 10. And that's all I'll say.
It's a fine movie. I love it.
But I'm looking up Sam Rockwell here. Yeah, this guy looks familiar. I'd have to reconsider it. I'll have to watch.
Well, I'll tell you this: he steals every scene whenever he's in any movie. He steals the scene from everyone. He was in Iron Man 2 with Robert Downey Jr. That guy, great actor, steals every scene, and he stole every scene from George Clooney in Confessions of a Dangerous Mind.
Oh, you know what? Maybe that's the most recent movie I've seen. I started watching it, and I had missed the first, like, 20 minutes of it, so I set it to record. I think it's sitting on my DVR. I got to watch that.
Nice, nice. Yeah, and Leo. I'll tell you this. I attribute almost all of Leo's success to NSYNC and Backstreet Boys, because that's the 90s. That's when it was Romeo and Juliet, Titanic, and The Man in the Iron Mask. And it was the whole culture. It was a great time to be a teenage girl in the 90s.
No, I don't know. We're going to have to agree to disagree. I mean, Leo is in all these great movies, and he's got, to me, I feel like he's got a wide enough range to say he's the best of all time. Cause every role I watch him in, I'm drawn into the character, and like, I can't wait for Leo to get back on the screen.
Not saying he doesn't do a good job. I respect your opinion. It's a good choice. Just, You know, you sell tickets when you're that pretty. That's all I'm saying.
That's true. I won't disagree with that. All right, fair enough. All right,
so hey, good conversation. You know, I really wanted to tell you what I think kept Aleister Crowley up at night, seething with jealousy. Because, you know, he was a big numbers guy. It was, you know, I don't have to tell you that.
Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, numerology? So, you're talking about, like, the gematria numerology kind of idea?
Like, you know, the 93 with the religion and everything. He was all... I think that's just him copying what God has already showed us. So, I'm going to try to tell you about the heptadic structure in the Bible. So, the listeners can play along. Imagine you are in college, I'm giving you an assignment, and you need to write a genealogy for me. However, the number of words in this genealogy has to be divisible by 7, with no remainder. All right? Okay. You could do that, right?
Okay. Uh-huh.
Yeah, pretty easy. Everyone at home still playing along? Well, also, I have a couple more things. The number of letters in the genealogy have to be divisible by 7. Hmm. Well, you could do that, especially with English. All right, well, I have a few more things for you. The number of vowels have to be divisible by 7. The number of consonants have to be divisible by 7. And the words that begin with a vowel have to be divisible by 7. Also, that begin with a consonant have to be divisible by 7. Now, anyone at home still playing along? That's pretty crazy.
Yeah,
so,
it is.
How about the number of words that occur more than once? Now you have to add that to I'm lost too at this point. Uh-huh. Words that occur in multiple forms, 7 words that are not nouns, the number of names, only 7 other kinds of nouns, the number of male names, all divisible by 7.
Huh.
Now, maybe some people already know what we're getting into here. This is what the genealogy of Christ is, as found in Matthew 1. All of those things.
Really?
That's right. However,
so you're talking about there's the verse that goes through all the genealogy?
Yes, yes.
Oh, okay.
However, there's 34 of those divisible by 7s, and I would just like to imagine Aleister Crowley being so jealous and wishing he could be that good at numerology.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah, so this heptadic structure in the Bible, I think it's the signature of our Creator. It's unsimulatable. I mean, if you can understand, at least just by random chance, if you have to have all of these things divide by 7, just by random, you lose 6 times and win once. Well, once you get to 7 to the 34th, that you're basically the chances of all of these things happening randomly. It would, if you had a supercomputer that could try 400 million tries per second, and if you had a million supercomputers, it would take over 4 million years. It is a signature of the Creator, and it's unsimulatable. And however, this all happens in the Greek. You can't pull out your King James Bible and try to figure this out. And the Greek is actually a more rigid and more structured. So it's...
Hmm. So if you take out... Because I've got a copy of the, the Septuagint. I think that's like the Greek original first translation from Hebrew to Greek.
Yes.
Interesting. So you're saying that this sort of, because as you were describing it, I'm thinking, okay, so like maybe there's a mathematician that could come up with a formula, and you're saying...
Well,
like,
actually, it was Dr. Ivan Panin. He was born in Russia and graduated from Harvard. Yeah, that's, he spent 50 years, and he has thousands of pages that he wrote on the heptadic structure in the Bible, and it's all throughout the Bible. Even Matthew 2 almost meets all of the same rules for this little assignment we got to play.
Oh, really? So it's not just the genealogy that has these characteristics. It's various parts of the Bible.
It's various parts. I wouldn't say it's every part of the Bible, but it's all throughout the Bible. Huh. And actually, it's an interesting thing because it proves that it has been translated well all throughout the years. Because if you move one letter or one word, now those things start to dissolve and you don't have that beauty anymore.
Interesting. Huh. Well, I've never heard that before. Yeah, I don't get much into the numerology stuff necessarily.
Right. If anyone wants to look it up, I'd point them to Dr. Chuck Missler. He is kind of like the opposite of you. He does deep dives into Christianity like you won't believe. He's a great teacher.
Right on. What was that name one more time? How do you spell that?
Dr. Chuck Missler. The late Dr. Chuck Missler. Yeah, I miss him.
Oh, okay. So he's not on social media then, I guess.
Oh, no, he's an old feller.
Okay, Chuck Nissler, got it.
Yeah, I know. When you start talking about numerology, it's almost like you're wearing a saran wrap suit.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. I know Crowley had this.
Everyone can see your nuts.
Crowley had all those sevens on that on his Star of Babylon and stuff. So, like, he
yeah, I think Satan wants to be God, and he was definitely, I think we would both agree, he was a servant of the devil.
Yeah.
Satan wants to copy God.
Interesting. Yeah, that seems to come up often in the world of conspiracy and spirituality crossover there.
Yeah, it's cool.
What you on your email, you mentioned something about evolution.
Yeah, I think we're running out of a little time. I'd just kind of like to end it and just, you know, okay. In 1 Corinthians 15, the Apostle Paul defines the gospel. That's the good news, that Jesus Christ was crucified, that he was buried, and that he rose again on the third day, and defeating death and paying for all of our sins of all of mankind. And it's really simple to take part in that forgiveness with the ABCs, because I'm a simple guy. And I would say just admit, that's the A, you're a sinner. Believe in Jesus Christ and call upon the name of the Lord, because Romans 10:13 says, all who call upon the name of the Lord will be saved. And I think I made a pretty good defense for the Bible being true just now.
Right on. I like that, man. A good Christian warrior here on conspiracy considerations. Last thing, you did mention something about Batman movies, though. You got any thoughts on the Batman movies?
Oh, yes. Quick thought on the Batman movies. I think the first movie was telling us about COVID. The second movie was talking about, you know, that was the Joker with Heath Ledger. That's letting all these prisoners out. And if you're following the news, they're just letting prisoners out all the time. And that's the chaos of everything. And then I think they're setting up some sort of a savior figure like Batman to, you know, save the city that was taken over by communist lefty rulers.
Interesting. Yeah. You know, I was just going to rewatch the Christopher Nolan trilogy there because I think they're all great movies. That's something I'll consider when I'm digging into that.
Awesome. Yeah, you know, it's a little out there, but they do the predictive programming thing every once in a while.
Yeah, they do. Definitely in the Batman movies too.
Oh yeah, let's not get into that. I don't want to get you any further trouble. I'm rooting for you, by the way.
Right on. Well, cool, man. Thanks for sharing your thoughts. You got any places you want the people to follow you on social media or websites or anything you want to plug?
I don't mess with any of the social media, but I would appreciate if you could put a link up for me for people to click.
Definitely. What's the link?
The link will it's just a pastor I like to follow. It's J.D. Farag. He has a little place in Hawaii. He preaches about the times we're living in right now.
Right on. So a link to J.D. Farag's website?
Yeah, just do a YouTube video.
Oh, okay. All right. Sounds good, man. All right.
Thanks so much for having me on. You have a great show.
Thank you. Appreciate that. We'll see ya.
Bye-bye.
All right, there you go. What do you think of that? We just pulled someone up from the crowd, and they dropped knowledge on you. I thought it was pretty interesting. Now, the Tier 4 conspiracy considerations, quick plug for it if you're not familiar with it. If you get on Patreon or IlluminatiWatcher.com's VIP section, the things you'll get, not only will you be on this show where you can share your theories with the whole audience. It's only 25,000 people, so no pressure. But you'll get, I'll send you a signed copy of Use Your Illusion 1. You'll get every ebook that I've written. You'll get the tier 2 perks of the monthly shout outs, and you'll get to the live stream. You'll get all the ebooks from T1, tier 1, that is, excuse me. No more ads. You hate the ads, I hate the ads. No commercials, no mercy. Plus all the bonus shows that I've put out for every month for a few years. You get it all, baby. You get it all. And by the way, there was 5 slots. When I created this tier, I put 5 slots on Patreon, and they're damn near sold out. So if for some reason you want it on and you can't get in there, hit up IlluminatiWatcher.com's VIP section. You can sign up there, and we'll get it on and popping. All right, thanks for your support. Link in the show notes, as always. But they get there, and they find that all the Norwegians are dead. And some of them committed suicide. It's a real bummer. Then they find a video recording
They find a big emptied out ice block. Real ominous. They retrieve these burnt up remains of what looks like an octopus man thing. And now they're like, okay, what the heck's going on? So they go back to the U.S. outpost, the U.S. camp there. They're examining this octopus man. This gooey, mangled mess of limbs and organs. And this is what puts the film on the map of the horror Hall of Fame. You have these revolutionary special effects, which, you know, is still, to this day, better than CGI. I don't know and a lot of people who weren't familiar, back in the 80s and 90s, Fangoria magazine, it was a whole magazine devoted to this sort of thing, about the special effects and the gore and the blood and all that stuff, and how they really did that and how they put it together. But it's a lot of work. The guy who made these sets, I think he had some kind of breakdown or something. Exhaustion or something to that effect, because they had him working so much. And they're standing around looking at the octopus man. And you'll see Kurt Russell standing there, old R.J. McCready standing there with the hidden hand. He's got his hand in his jacket. Again, photo will be on the Instagram. And then another photo will have back to the dog named Jed. Well, the dog, he's been creeping around the camp. And we find out why they were trying to shoot this dog. Because, you see, it's infected with the aliens. And it transforms, it split opens like a burnt sausage. And now it turns into this spider octopus thing. And it's shooting liquid at the other dogs. Which you'll also, by the way, see in Prince of Darkness, which is our next film review that we'll do. Which I'd argue is a much better film than The Thing. Not a popular opinion, but hey, I'm not a popular guy. And then another fun side note, I'm a fan of Billie Holiday. You hear Billie Holiday, Don't Explain, in the scene where they're playing the cards right around this point. Anyway, so the dog, old Jed, he morphs into this thing. He's killing the other dogs. And the humans catch on because they hear quite the ruckus. They show up with the weapons because, again, these are some badass nerds. And you see the creature has the all-seeing eye. Again, we get another all-seeing eye. Again, I'll have that photo up. You'll take a look, see what you think. So before they kill it, you'll see the all-seeing eye. Then you hear, they start to figure it out. They start putting the pieces together, and we hear that this alien actually imitates life forms. And they caught this one before it would mutate into the dog.
You see, what we're talking about here is an organism that imitates other life forms, and it imitates them perfectly. When this thing attacked our dogs, it tried to digest them, absorb them, and in the process, shape its own cells to imitate them. This, for instance, that's not dog. It's imitation. We got to it before it had time to finish.
Finish what?
Finish imitating these dogs.
Now, this is what some argue, that they argue the aliens need the humans for this. They want to get our souls to incorporate into their being, which is kind of what you see in this movie. That's what, in User Illusion 1, I talked about how the souls were containers. Or, I'm sorry, the human body is a container for the soul. And the aliens, they want us for the soul. That's what they need to animate. And that's what Bob Lazar was basically saying, that they referred to us as containers and all kinds of stuff. So you see this sort of idea with the thing. They need the souls. They came here to host upon the humans. Well, then they finally decide they're going to watch this videotape. Another plot inconsistency. I mean, that would have been the first thing I'd watch. Anyways, they finally, from the Norwegian camp, they got the video. They're like, you know what, let's watch this video. And they see that the Norwegians were actually digging around and found a UFO. but it's not clear what they found on the footage exactly. And what's curious, again, I'll put this photo up. You'll see this curious lineup of men, similar to what you'll see in Prince of Darkness, where you have the homeless harbingers of the apocalypse. Well, you kind of see that in The Thing. That's the Norwegians. John Carpenter showing us how man will bring about his own end. Next, they head up to where the Norwegians were digging around. They go back up there because they see it on the video and they think, what the heck's going on? So they find a UFO and they think, okay, this thing is like over 100,000 years old. The Norwegians, they busted the UFO open when they drilled down, and turns out that's what got the alien busted loose. And it's funny because when they're talking to the scientists at the outpost, they're debating, they're calling it voodoo bullshit. And the one guy, he actually cites Eric Von Daniken's Chariots of the Gods.
I don't know. Thousands of years ago, it crashes and this thing gets thrown out or crawls out and it ends up freezing in the ice.
I just cannot believe any of this voodoo bullshit.
Charles, happens all the time, man. They're falling out of the skies like flies. Government knows all about it, right, Mac?
You believe any of this voodoo bullshit, Blair?
Charles, Chariots of the Gods, man. They practically own South America. I mean, they taught the Incas everything they know.
But yeah, they think the government knows all about this. They come to the conclusion that the alien got dug up in the ice block and now it's been unleashed. Uh-oh, what's going to happen? Well, the brains of this outfit, Dr. Blair, a.k.a. Wilford Brimley without the Wolver stash, he doctors up an Atari simulation. And he confirms, which again, another thing you'll see in Prince of Darkness, by the way. Lots of programming. And he confirms, he's like, okay, the alien cell will assimilate into the host cell, and the new entity is created through absorption, and maybe a little diabetes for good measure, I don't know. But worse yet, he's convinced the entire population will become infected. It's a wrap. It's a wrap for the human race, and he's figured it all out. Which is a little bit of alchemical, you know, solve coagula. Because the new entity has to assimilate into the whole cell, has to sort of rebuild. Has to destroy the human nihilistically so that it can create something new and coagulate into something new. Meanwhile, the remains of this dog alien thing, they're still not dead. It's awake. And it's hungry. And it starts snatching up nerds. It wants to consume. It wants to imitate people. So now it's on and popping. RJ McCready and the crew versus everybody. They got fire pits, flamethrowers, alien bodies. Everything must go. But then you got Dr. Blair. Dr. Blair, you see, he's got the nerd anger. He's upset. And the nerd anger consumes him. And he starts shooting at everyone. Just like Hayden Christensen's, you know, Darth Vader when he was a boy. When he lost his mind and killed that whole village. That nerd anger takes over. And that's what old Wilford Brimley does. He starts shooting at everyone. He starts tearing up the chopper and the escape vehicles because he's worried that his computer simulation was 100% accurate and that the aliens are going to eventually kill all of humanity, which, by the way, these computer simulations are always full of assumed variables. It's information, but it's not always helpful, okay? And that's the problem. That's why I always say the nerds are going to kill us. They rely way too much on technologies and models and simulations, but they don't have all the variables, so, like, how can we rely on them so much? I don't know. Anyway, they subdue Dr. Blair, but it's too late. The choppers, the radios, everything's done. It's wrecked. And Blair, he implies that one of the people in the camp have already been imitated by the alien, And the crew buys into that also. They want to see if one of them, one of the crew, is actually the alien or not. Because they think it's evolved quick enough that now it's not turning into octopus spider goo. Now it's able to fully look like a human being. And if you watch it, you'll notice how it really does transform people a little bit better as it goes along. So it makes sense. It's got it all figured out by now. So the crew, they start turning on each other. Everyone's getting paranoid. A major plot theme of COVID-19, right? Nobody trusts anybody. Everyone has to prepare their own meals and eat out of cans because they're worried about alien particles getting on their food. Dr. Blair's begging to be let back in the camp because they quarantined his ass in a building outside. He keeps like saying, "Oh, I feel fine now. Sorry, I tried to shoot everybody." But they don't believe him. And then what ensues for like 30 minutes is the crew accusing each other who's the alien, who's not. Bodies getting ripped open, revealing alien presence. Tearing apart the victims, torsos splitting open, heads running around on spider legs, which you see in It Part 2, by the way. But this, this masterpiece of horror of special effects really, really does its thing. Now, R.J. MacReady, he decides, you know what, we don't know who's the alien, who's not, who's the thing. We're going to draw blood from everyone to see who it is. And the idea here is that small parts of the whole are built in, like a drop of sea of alien consciousness that is designed to fight back against the attack. Unlike human species, which is just inert tissue, they're going to put everyone's blood in a little petri dish, hit it with a little fire, see if it reacts.
You tie a palmer over here. We're gonna draw a little bit of everybody's blood. Because we're gonna find out who's the thing. Watching Norris in there gave me the idea that maybe every part of him was a whole. Every little piece was an individual animal with a built-in desire to protect its own life. You see, when a man bleeds, it's just tissue. The blood from one of you things won't obey when it's attacked. It'll try and survive. Crawl away from a hot needle, say.
So he tests the blood. He's collecting the samples. He actually puts a heated up wire to see how it reacts. This is one of the best moments of the film, honestly. R.J. MacReady, he's got everyone tied up as he's testing the blood samples through his own theory that he concocted of blood fighting back. Everyone's skeptical. No one's happy with this. And he tests the blood of one guy that he actually already shot and killed because the guy tried attacking MacReady. And you don't attack Kurt Russell unless you want to catch hot lead. And the blood doesn't react. And then Keith David, his character Childs, is like, "Well, the blood didn't react, so now you're a murderer." And Kurt Russell, R.J. MacReady here, he just looks at him and he's like, he's not even fazed by this. He's like, "Now I'm going to test Palmer's blood." He doesn't skip a beat. He just moves it along. Gotta love it. Gotta love it. Now, the thing wants to freeze itself back to sleep. So it blows the generator that was the source of heat. MacReady, he decides he's going to light everything on fire to keep the alien, the thing, from refreezing as a form of mutual suicide. They intend to blow everything up so that the thing dies, so will they, but they don't care. They're okay with that. And then here comes Dr. Blair. And he starts, he's the thing now, and he starts killing. And the final iteration of the thing appears. And MacReady tosses a stick of dynamite at it. The whole outpost blows up. MacReady somehow survives, as does Childs, Keith David's character. They're the last two. And this is where it gets real dicey. We're not given a clear understanding if either men are now the thing. Carpenter allegedly claimed that Childs is clearly not breathing out in the cold air while MacReady is, implying that Childs is in fact now the alien. And when you watch it, you can see MacReady heavily breathing freezing cold air. This, you know, it's condensation you can see on the camera there. And Childs, he doesn't really, except for there's one spot where you can see it. So, I mean, it's like 95% accurate. So, maybe the film just screwed up for the one breath. Another idea is that Childs still has his earring, so he couldn't be the alien because the thing removes earrings and such. And that's apparently as per the sequel, or the prequel, which I haven't seen. But in the novella, MacReady discovers that Dr. Blair, who's the thing, has been building an anti-gravity device to escape. And this is what you see in the movie. You'll see that Dr. Blair is building a craft from spare helicopter parts underground. Because the alien wants to either, like, get out of there or refreeze itself. So, that's the whole movie. In conclusion, like I alluded to in the Carpenter setup, where I talked about the Carpenter Apocalypse trilogy, this film is about annihilation. It's about nihilism. It puts the nihilism in annihilation. It's the annihilation of self. Nobody's sure about who they are or if they are even they. Maybe they are now an alien. They just don't know. A worm buried into the subconscious, manifests into pure horror as the crew members, they fight each other and themselves at the same time. Not sure who is who. Not sure if they are truly who they think they are. We got a little bit of Rene Descartes, I think, therefore I am, annihilated as the people die, not being aware of the basic tenets of their own consciousness. Their thoughts exist, but are they even theirs? And to me, this is some great reset stuff. This is the end of everything you know. The new normal, this is what it's all about. And the thing, to me, is just like COVID. Trust breaks down entirely, and we create a new form, a new normal. At least that's what they want. I don't know if you heard my 4-part series on the Great Reset, but it's very important. Now, it has vibes of H.P. Lovecraft, which we'll actually get more into with In the Mouth of Madness, because that story is also reminiscent to At the Mountains of Madness, where scientists unearth ancient aliens in Antarctica. You see these themes recurring over and over. And then, of course, finally, it also has those Bob Lazar-type influences where, you know, either he was familiar with this tale and it informed him of the reality that he experienced, or there's more truth and fiction in these movies, and we actually have these UFOs in Antarctica, because that's what Lazar said. He said there was several craft, I believe it was 9, that we recovered. And curiously enough, on the thing, Dr. Blair's working on an anti-gravity device, just like Bob Lazar was doing out at Area 51 and S4. Alright, I hope you enjoyed that. That was the thing. And the next film, my friend, is going to be Prince of Darkness, which to me is one of my favorite horror movies of all time. To me, easily the best film in the trilogy. That's not a popular opinion, so take that for what it's worth. But we're going to get into the Prince of Darkness, and we're going to get a little nihilism, we're going to get a little religious elements, and we're going to have a great time. So until next time, my friend, you know what to do. Stay woke.